Blog Talk Radio.
The scriptures clearly teach is that we, as believers, should know history. God tells us in passages like Romans 15:4 and Isaiah 43. He tells us also in 1 Corinthians 10 and Hebrews 11 and Psalm 73 and 78 and so many other places. He says to recall the former days, to remember the former times. Throughout the scriptures, we see that when a people remembers their history, they behave differently than when they forget their history. We see that even recovering histories, in the case of Josiah and the temple, leads to a national revival. Or in the case of Esther and Mordecai, the use of history by the king one night kept Mordecai from being hanged on the gallows and thus preserved the nation. So history is huge. God is into it. But in America, we don't do a good job of knowing our own history, and we need to. The scripture says that his people perish for lack of knowledge. We've been taught in America for years that what we're about is economics. We formed this nation because of taxation without representation. We need to know our history better. Taxation without representation does appear in the Declaration of Independence, but it's only one out of 27 issues that appear there. There's also religious issues. There's moral issues. There's so many other things than what we just hear today on economics. We need to go back and see that we were founded in this nation. Four clauses of the Declaration say that they didn't want activist judges. Two clauses say they wanted to end slavery. We have clauses over preserving the right to have Bible societies and other religious exercises. So as Christians, we need to know our history. We don't need to just go with what we've been taught. We ought to go back and read the documents. It's one thing to be taught what the Bible says. It's another thing to read it. So I challenge you. Follow up on what God says in the Scriptures. Know our history. Recall the former days. Let's go back and look at some of the patriots we had that were such strong Christians that are leaders that we don't even hear about today. So I challenge you. Do some research. Go to websites. Look at things that will tell you about your faith history as a Christian. It's important you know that so that you know how to behave today.
Welcome, listeners, to City on a Hill. We're so grateful that you've tuned in. And as always, we ask that you invite your friends and family throughout the country to come join us, come and learn with us. God does not want us to perish for lack of knowledge. And we at City on a Hill are so grateful for the caliber of guests that he has given us. They are, I believe, anointed by God for such a time as this. And today we have a special guest, Mr. Henry Berg. I just want to say hello first. Hi, Mr. Henry.
How are you, Diana?
I am doing good, Mr. Henry. I am blessed. We are blessed to live in the land of the free, the home of the brave. And I want to say another hello to another brave here, Dawn Wildman. I see her joining us. Hello, Dawn. How are you?
I'm good, Diana. Hi, Henry. How are you today?
Just great, Dawn. How about you?
Good, good, good. I think there are a lot of things going our way these days, so I feel very optimistic.
Well, that's great.
Well, we're so excited about today's show, and I have sent Dawn a copy of the really your article, Mr. Henry. We've got it on our website, cityonahill.tv, for anybody that would like it. It is awesome. Two titles. You are so studious, Mr. Henry. You know, your background as an engineer, I could just really go on, and I will talk about it. But the two titles, if anybody wants to go and just follow us in this conversation, this is a very important conversation that the whole country needs to be really listening to. The first part of your article is on Obama and his failure to create jobs. Obama has failed to create jobs is title on it, and the part two of the blog is Obama the Jobs Killer, and I love the way that you have really set this apart, Mr. Mayor, because we really need to concentrate on both of these one at a time. We need to understand where he has failed to create jobs and where he has killed jobs. Those are important for this, you know, time that we're facing, because the future of America is at stake. We the people have to know the truth. But anyway, I'm so glad Dawn is in, because Dawn, as you know, Mr. Henry, is a member of a big, well, the largest Tea Party group in the country, right, Dawn?
Absolutely. California has the largest coalition of Tea Party groups in the country, and I swear it's just because we have more stuff we're trying to fix. But whatever it is, we have a lot of dedicated souls and people that are working hard. So I'm really excited about today's show to hear what Mr. Henry's put together.
And Mr. Henry, you know, I asked Donna a lot of times to come on, and I mean, I'm just so grateful when she is able to come on, and I thank God she's on today because the information you will share with us will be multiplied a thousandfold because of what Don usually does with the information. as a former national coordinator of Tea Party, of a large Tea Party group, she got to know a lot of people in the Tea Parties all over the country and really all over the world, to the point that we had somebody from Tea Party Italia, Don, that just got on. I think he just got here in the U.S. probably this morning.
Yeah, he just got to Dallas over the weekend, and I'm looking forward to hopefully touching base with him since he's there. But Luca's in Dallas working on the Ted Cruz campaign, and I couldn't be more excited for him. I'm sure he's going to bring back to Tea Party Italia a lot of great news and strategy, and so it's going to be good.
And Mr. Henry, he is like he reminds me of Alexander de Tocqueville, because he's really speaking loudly about our Constitution. As you know, it is so necessary for us to survive, because the rest of the world really needs us to survive. Our Constitution is just such an important document. And with that in mind, I'll get started with asking you some questions because, you know, God is so good. You know, He is, the truth is God. God is truth. And He wants you to learn the truth. He doesn't want you to base it just really on hearsay. He wants you to get to know Him. He wants you to get to know the truth Himself. And so, He has gifted you, Mr. Henry, with your background in engineering, with that mind where you analyze every detail. Because as an engineer, if your foundation is not right, that bridge will not hold up, you know, to hold what it should hold. A building cannot hold up what it should hold. Nothing can do what it's supposed to do if you do not engineer it according to really the proper specifications where it is, you know, doing the job that it's supposed to do. And I could really tell a lot more about you, but if you don't mind, Mr. Henry, just tell a little bit about yourself. You can do it better than anybody else, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, thanks for the comments there, Diana and Don as well. I have spent my entire career in construction, you know, about 40 years or so. Have a bachelor's and master's in civil engineering, and really enjoyed the construction industry. But then, you know, I built lots of different types of projects all over the country. And Don, I worked on a refinery out in California at the beginning of my career up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that was a fun experience. And I've also been, you know, in quite a few different states building different construction projects. But the part that I think is quite exciting for me right now is number one, whenever our church or a Christian university here in town is building a major project, I'm in charge of it on behalf of the owner, you know, as a full-time volunteer. So that's been a really fun thing since I retired. Then the other aspect has been kind of gotten off into these writing of different articles and reports, and these have been on lots of different subjects. You know, the economy, jobs, taxes, employment, unemployment, and then quite a few articles really in the education area. I'm very interested in education on the national level as well as at states, and so that's been a fun thing. I've joint ventured in that with an education expert, Donna Garner, and she lives in Texas, and it's really been fun to work on various projects with her as well.
Well, Mr. Henry, I really, and you know, Don has heard you before, and I think of all the news, you know, and mainstream media, it's so sad that our national networks, you know, do not hear you, because you speak of facts. These are not just things that are made up. Everything has a basis for it. And so I'm going to go ahead and get started, because I have allotted you, I hope, plenty of time, 2 hours, I hope. But I'm going to do the first part, 45 minutes, and Ms. Barbara is going to do the rest. I'm going to leave you in her hands when I get off. But and Dawn, you can stay as long as you can. But I'm going to go ahead and let you set this up for us, Mr. Henry, with the first article is on Obama. And here are the facts where, indeed, he has failed to create jobs. So if you don't mind, I'll let you get started.
Okay, that'd be great. Yes, as Diana has mentioned, both of these articles are on Diana's and Barbara's website, City on a Hill, and so you can find those there. There's also links to these articles various other places. First one, you know, this first part, Obama has failed to create jobs. So really we want to kind of look at this a little bit, and first of all, I think we need to understand that the government doesn't really create jobs. And even Obama's press secretary has actually admitted that the government doesn't create jobs, you know, except for government workers. But the government can play a huge role. So really, we do kind of loosely say that the government creates jobs. You see, if the government doesn't get out of the way, if they set up the wrong environment for jobs, then they destroy jobs. They cannot create jobs. So the government policies do have a huge influence in job creation. So let's just look at a couple different aspects to this. One is, you know, the Obama and the Democrats talk a lot about how many jobs they have created. So that's one thing that I'd like to look at a little bit today. Another aspect is how many jobs have been created since he took office in January 20th, 2009. And then finally, let's look at a major measure, the stimulus bill. And let's kind of look at that a little bit and see if that has done anything for the economy. What was your question? Go ahead.
Let me go ahead. I'm a little bit remiss. Usually Ms. Barbara is here to start off with a prayer, and I want to do that just like the founders did, because we know that, you know, in this, whatever we're trying to do, we need his guidance so that the people hopefully will understand what we're trying to share. So if you don't mind, Mr. Henry, I'm going to just ask Dawn. I know she loves to pray. Dawn, would you please help us and pray over this conversation that may go well?
Absolutely. It'd be my honor. Dear Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for all the blessings you give us each and every day, the blessing of each other, the blessing of you, the blessing of the knowledge that you've imparted through the Bible, through the sage people in our lives, through people such as Mr. Henry Burke, Diana, Miss Barbara, Mr. Wayne, and everybody else connected with this show. Please continue to protect these people and hold them in your grace as they continue to try to shine the light on the evils of those that would separate us from you. We ask for all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Henry. I just love what Benjamin Franklin says. So I'll try to start our business here with prayer. But go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Don. That really is important to start our session in prayer, because, you know, without our Lord, where would we be? So that's, you know, obviously very, very important. You know, I guess I'd have to apologize to people. There are going to be lots of numbers here, but that's kind of my nature. You know, I don't like to talk in generalities. I'd like to, sort of a fixation, I suppose, on numbers. But, you know, you can't be just approximate in the engineering or construction world. And Diana, you captured that quite well in terms of a bridge and those types of things. So I will talk about a lot of numbers, and I hope that isn't boring to people. But I do like to support and back up, you know, what I'm saying with facts. So let's look at the current job picture. And if you don't mind, I think what I'll do here today when we talk about this, let's to keep everything on the correct basis, these two reports, Obama has failed to create jobs and Obama the job killer, both of those I released on August 31st. So that's about 3 weeks ago. What I think I'll do, if it's okay, I'll stay with the numbers that we had in these two reports. In case someone is following along, they'll get a little bit confused if I jump ahead. So I'll stay with that date and the jobs report that was available at the time. And then on Wednesday, when we talk about this next subject, which is Romney's plan will create millions of jobs, on that one, what I'll do is jump to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics jobs report. So if someone is following along, yes, it will follow the report, and I think that's important, but what we will discuss today is not the latest jobs numbers. But if you can follow all that chatter, I think that's kind of the direction we'll go. So let's look at the current job picture. And again, this would be the current job picture 1 month ago. And so let's just kind of see where we stand. First of all, we need to understand that the recession technically is over. It started in December 2007, and it lasted through June of 2009. So really, you know, after you have a recession, you're in recovery. So we would call this the Obama recovery. And most of the time, when I'm writing about this, I put the recovery in quotes, because I'll tell you what, you would never know that it's recovery. You know, technical terms it is, because that's what you have after recession. But this recovery is really weak, and it's actually the weakest recovery since the Great Depression. And by the way, this recession that we just are coming out of, technically are out of the recession, some people like to term that and call it the Great Recession. And I refuse to use that term because it's not the greatest. We've had recessions worse than this. But I think it's Obama and his troops, they've kind of coined that term, Great Recession, in order to make us think that this is the worst one we've ever had. And we've had, you know, 11 recessions since World War II. And, you know, this one, yeah, this one's tough. But this is an old joke, and I think, or it's not a joke, but I heard it probably 20 years ago, and it says, I guess it goes something like this. It's a recession when someone else is out of work. It's a depression when you are out of work. And, of course, that technically that's not correct at all, but it's just kind of a dumb little thing that people have said. So anyway,
let me make sure I understand. You're going to go over Obama has failed to create jobs today, and on Wednesday you're going to go over part two. Is that what you're wanting to do?
Well,
we're going to do part one, part two today.
I think we'll do one and two today. And then Wednesday, it'll be the separate report, and that's Romney's plan will create millions of jobs.
Okay. That's what I had thought, so I just want to make sure I had that clear. But let me ask you this, because you were saying that, you know, the recovery was at such and such. Would you mind telling us in that, and I think you were trying to define the recovery, you're talking about on what basis is it considered that that it is now at, you know, we're at the recovery phase. What were some of the variables that says that, you know, we should be in a recovery, that the recession has stopped?
Okay.
I'm just trying to put it in my mind.
No, that's fine. That's fine. There's a group that determines, it's on a national level, and they determine what is called a recession and what is called a recovery. And it's a national group, and they have a definite definition for what is a recession and what is a recovery. And they go through a number of different steps, and without getting, you know, too complicated about it, they don't define it on the terms that the typical person does, and that is, you know, it's an incorrect definition. They'll say that, okay, you know, a recession is two successive quarters of, you know, where your GDP is going down. And actually, this national group does not define it that way. They go through many more steps in order to actually determine if it's a recession and if it's a recovery. And
okay.
They have made this determination, and so I guess we have to go with that the recession.
I see what you're saying. I just wanted to have a point, and I'm glad you told me that, because that's what they do. That's what they're best at, is gauging all these variables and being able to say, okay, we're at this point. So, okay, so I got that.
Right.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, that's fine. So really, we've had a very stagnant job market ever since Obama took office. You know, you remember he told us that unemployment would never go below 8%. Well, the day that he was sworn in, January 20th, 2009, during that month of January, the unemployment rate was 7.7%. Well, the very next month, February, it jumped up, and it's been up ever since. It's been over 8% in spite of all of his measures and spending of money. So, you know, we've had unemployment above 8% for 43 straight months, and that's the longest period on record of unemployment over 8%. So it's really a weak recovery by any measure. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, they are the folks that I rely upon, and most people do, for the jobs numbers. Now, you can fault them in various ways. I'd rather not get into all of that. You know, they have two different studies, for example. It's surveys that they use to determine unemployment rates. But let's just go with their numbers. I think that's the best thing to do at this point, is accept those at face value. And, by the way, those reports are issued. It's the Employment Situation Summary. Those come out the first Friday of every month for the previous month. And so, for example, on August 3rd, we got the unemployment numbers for July. And then we got those for August. We got those the first week of September. So on October 5th, that's Friday, not this coming Friday, but the following Friday, we will get the new unemployment numbers. And those, of course, will be for the month of September. So you can kind of see the timing on the way that sure. stuff works. And what they said in this report that was released by the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, on August 3rd, they said that 12.8 million people, let's call it 13 million, were unemployed. And they also said that the long-term unemployed, and they define long-term unemployed as those people who have been jobless for 27 weeks or longer. So that, in other words, they're saying these are people who have been out of work for at least 6 months. Again, their numbers say that it's 5.2 million people. That's 41% of the unemployed have been out of work for longer than 6 months. And Dawn and Diana, I just want to ask you and maybe anyone else thinking about this, how do those people get by? Can you picture someone who has been out of work for 6 months? What do you think, Dawn? How do they survive?
They don't, and that's why you're seeing people have to take in roommates or people downsizing. People are just walking away from their homes. I mean, these aren't people who just worked as a luxury. That's the interesting thing. You know, the mm-hmm. government acts like everybody was doing it for a hobby. These are people that had to work to make a living, and they
That's
don't.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's really tough. It's really tough. And, you know, I have a lot of compassion for these people who are out of work. You know, when our country has an environment that destroys jobs, that doesn't create jobs, that's why it's almost a personal thing with me. We've got to think about those people who are out of work, and we've got to do something that makes the situation better. There's another category that's really quite important, and I think sometimes we often forget about this group, and it's the so-called underemployed. And I sometimes put that in quotes to or underline it so that people can differentiate between underemployed and employed. And what that category includes, and again, this is a BLS definition. I didn't just make this stuff up. The underemployed category includes those folks who are unemployed, the ones that are part-time for economic reasons, and the ones that are marginally attached. And when I add up those numbers, the unemployed, the part-time for economic reasons, and marginally attached, I get 23.6 million people. So in round numbers, let's just keep it simple. There are 13 million unemployed and 23 to 24 million underemployed people in this country. And that's a lot of folks. There's another thing that we need to maybe look at a little bit, and I hope this is not getting too much into the weeds, but they talk about the labor force participation rate. And right now, that is at 63.8%. And traditionally, it's been about 65.8%. So it's down significantly from what it traditionally is. And that's simply what they're doing there. Fancy term, I suppose, labor force participation rate. And you simply take the number of people who are employed and divide that by the labor force. And when you divide those two, the percentage is called the labor force participation rate. So it's quite low today, which tells you that a lot of people have given up hope. They've dropped out of the job market. And, you know, in many of these surveys, when you've dropped out of the job market, you're not even counted, and because you are not part of the labor force. So if you're not part of the labor force, then you know, it drives the unemployment rate down. So it's a lousy situation. We have
Mr. Henry, I think that is so wrong to not count those people.
It is. It's a distortion, but that's the way the numbers are generated. So you know. And I guess the other way that I would look at things, and, you know, we've discussed this before in terms of the national debt, so, but I might just review it very, very briefly, and I hope it doesn't bore you to tears. But, you know, prior to a few years ago, it seems like everyone who talked about the national debt and how much it had grown, what they did is they went to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, and they grabbed their numbers and ran with it. Well, the CBO, they always talk about fiscal years, not just the CBO, but, you know, OMB and all White House and everyone else. Fiscal year. Well, what is that? That fiscal year ends September 30th. So we're getting pretty close to the end of the fiscal year. So what would happen? They would say, okay, from fiscal year 2011 to 2012 or whatever, this is how much it went up. Well, the problem in that whole deal is that you would get a mixture. Let's say between Bush and Obama, it was kind of a hodgepodge between the two presidents. So what I've chosen to do is let's keep everything simple. I'm kind of a simple guy, you know, and I say, okay, what was the national debt number on the day that Obama took office, January 20th, 2009, and what is it today? I subtract the two numbers, and that's how much the national debt has grown. So why not use the same approach when we look at employment? So that's what I've done. I look at unemployment in January. They don't have it for every day. So I simply take, okay, what were the numbers for January 2009? Number of people unemployed, employed, all those kinds of things, labor force participation rate, whatever you want to look at. I simply go to the report that was released in February 2009, which captured the employment picture for January 2009. And then I compare those numbers with today. You follow me, what I'm doing? So I simply, it's just a series of subtractions and a few divisions. And so I've got a little chart in the report that shows, okay, here are the numbers for January 2009. In the next column, we have the numbers for July 2012. And I simply subtract the numbers, and that's the change. So, for example, the population has increased in that period of time, 3.5 years, by 8.6 million people. But the labor force has only increased by about 0.9 million, which is 873,000. So there's something really wrong here. That's right. So by doing those comparisons side by side, and I don't think anyone can fault the analysis or the approach. Okay, what was it when Obama took office, and what is it today? And at the time that I wrote this report, I could go through July of 2012. So on that same analysis, let's look at one particular factor. Again, right out of the BLS reports, and people can go to those reports and you can duplicate the information. I think it's important for people to be able to verify this information. So when you go to the report for January 2009, it will give you the number of people who were employed. And then I will look for that same number for the July 2012 report. And I find that actually the number of people employed has dropped by 1,000 between January 2009 and July 2012. Dropped. That's in spite of the population going up by over 8 million people. So, you know, let's look at, I think it's important to look at the number of people employed. You know, you get all this chatter about jobs created and all that stuff. Well, sometimes it gets a little bit confusing. So I try to keep everything a little bit simple and look at the number of people employed. So really, big picture stuff, there are fewer people employed today in the labor force than out of the labor force than were when Obama was sworn in. The number of unemployed people, again, between those two dates, when he was sworn in and today, the number of unemployed people has grown by 875,000. So it grew from 7.7% to 8.3%. And as I mentioned, this labor force participation rate, which is simply dividing these two numbers, the unemployed by the labor force, it's actually dropped, and it's 63.7%. That's the lowest participation rate since about 1984. So it's been a long time since it's been that low. The other thing, and I think we've mentioned a little bit on your programs before, but if you don't mind, I'll go through this a little bit, and that is, I think it's always important to reference our jobs created, lost, employed, whatever, with the population growth. And I think it's probably fairly easy to understand that our country is growing, and fortunately we are, in terms of population. Now, you know, we've taken various population measures, and I know all of us, we could probably, I don't want to get off the subject, but, you know, we could probably dwell on abortion for several programs, and you've had numerous excellent programs on that subject. But, you know, we know that when you kill babies in the womb, those are fewer people who will be living today. So, you know, that's something that's taken place. But let's look at this population growth. Okay, the last 3.5 years, simply look at the population that we had in January 2009 and compare that with the population today, and it's grown by 8.6 million people, that many more people today than we had back then. Okay, when I divide that through, I find that, you know, you can get a number of people, 8.615 divided by 42 months. It's about 0.205 million per month. Let's call it, you know, a little over 200,000 per month is what the population growth has been. And when I multiply that times the labor force participation rate, I get a number, and I hope this is, I'm not getting really too complicated here, but what I was trying to derive and prove for myself is how many new jobs must be created simply to break even with population growth.
Yeah.
And the number that I generated was 135,000. And by the way, I've heard lots of different sources. I hear different numbers, and some people will say 150,000. That's fine. I'll buy that. Some people will say 200,000. I think that's a little bit on the high side. So I would like to say that it takes 135,000 or 150, somewhere in there. It takes that many new jobs per month simply to break even to keep up with population growth. So you're not getting ahead. So if you hear someone bragging, you know, like Obama or one of the Democrats, you hear them bragging about creating all these new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of simply gauge their conversation by this, saying, okay, I remember something on this City on a Hill program where they talked about 150,000 jobs. Okay, I would say let's use this as our back pocket rule of thumb. Until we get over 150,000 jobs per month created, we're just treading water, and we're not getting anywhere. And actually, what it takes is, unless you consistently produce about 200,000 new jobs a month, for month mm-hmm. after month, you mm-hmm. are not going to see the unemployment rate drop, mm-hmm. you know, because we've got more people next month because of population growth than we have this month. So, you know, let's kind of keep that number in mind, the 150,000, and bear in mind that we need to get up around 200,000 consistently before we can really put a dent into that unemployment rate. And more importantly, let's get away from these numbers and percentages. I still want to go back to these 23 million folks who are underemployed.
Wow.
We've got to do something to get those folks back to work.
Well, Mr. Henry, I hate to say this a little bit, but you know, when I hear you and you're breaking it down and you're saying we need that many jobs to break even, and that's a month. That's a month. So all the months that you have not done that, wow, that's an accumulation of deficit of jobs. And, you know, the picture of the young people that's living with their parents. If I was a young person, how in the world would I want to vote for an administration that, you know, is really in deficit, so my chance of getting a new job is almost zero?
That's exactly right. And, you know, you've seen these advertisements, and I think some of those capture it quite well. They'll show someone, you know, living in their parents' basement, you know, and they're a college graduate, and yet they cannot find a job, so, you know, they're having to do that. And I think I've heard numbers as high as maybe 50% of college grads are having to, you know, stay in their parents' bedrooms. And, boy, that's not exactly what their plan was for their lives. So it's a tough
deal. Well, let me ask Don, what do you think about the figures that he has just given? Because, to tell you the truth, I've not heard anybody give it and do a breakdown like Mr. Henry has.
And no, and you won't, because every day we have to admit to what the true number is, that we're not looking at an unemployment rate of 8.1, but probably more like 17 or 19%, not even counting those that are out of the job market, it becomes devastating. I mean, the fact is, everything sort of slides off of this one issue, which is why the Democrats never want to talk about it, you know, and that's why entitlements become so important, because just think, if you said to people, guess what, welfare to work is still going to be the policy, and so in 2 years you have to either be through, you found a job, or be through a vocational program that gets you a job, or any of these other things, you know, if there was a time limit to it, even unemployment, you would be in big trouble because the first thing people are going to notice is there isn't a job to get. I'm unemployed. I've been unemployed since February. I look every single day at multiple job boards in the newspaper. And it's not that there aren't jobs. There are plenty of jobs. The irony is I've never felt more underqualified in my whole entire life. And there are scads of jobs for people who have experience in various industries, mainly healthcare right now, or computers. And so if you're somebody who doesn't at any point in your life, if you have a liberal arts degree and you're just getting out of college, I don't know where the heck you're going to find a job. And I'm sort of in that same boat, you know. So, you know, it's really an interesting time. I'm finding more and more that this whole experience of being unemployed not only has humbled me, but I see the numbers completely in a different light. When you're actually the person experiencing it, it becomes a different matter. And I'm so glad, Henry, that you're bringing the actual figures and facts, because the reality is none of us are going to go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and look at any of this stuff. I've gone there for other projects, and it is a nightmare to go through. Fortunately, you have one of those brains that can, you know, that's your gift. You can look at this stuff, decipher it, and make it the bare bones for the rest of us. And that's what's so important about you and what you've done in this program, is that you've put it into bite-sized pieces that now make sense to us.
Indeed, I wrote down some notes, Mr. Henry. I read it last night. I was writing down some notes, and one of them was what you just pointed out about the 150,000 monthly new job that is required, because we are growing in population, and we have all these young people. I've got a poster that somebody emailed me, and I posted it on Facebook, and it's got the new normal. After graduation, you'll need to know how to fill out government forms, like food stamps, unemployment, energy assistance, public housing, disability, health care, and child care. And that is so true, and it is so sad, because that's not what we want for our children, and that's not what we want for us. And so thank you, Mr. Henry. But anyway, I'll get off my bandwagon and let you finish. Sorry.
Well, yeah.
I want to just point out one thing, though, about what you just said, though, Diana, is that so if you're a normal, compassionate Christian like all of us here are, you know, we're completely flummoxed by this whole situation. But there is a part of you that says, no wonder this has become a cycle of behavior with Democrats, these people voting these Democrats in, because at some stage you feel hopeless, you feel depressed, you feel like you have no other way to support your family but to get on the government dole. How else are you going to put food in your family's mouth? And most people, I don't care where you come from or what your circumstances are, you're not necessarily proud of that. Most people have a huge desire to be independent and self-sufficient. But we have built in a system that literally forces people to have no other place to go. And it's because of the very subject Henry's talking about, job creation.
Oh, indeed. And this administration is not here to fix the job problem, Mr. Henry, which you're going to go over. It's not here to fix it, because we know it is fixable. You're showing us. You know, the facts are here, and you're going to show us more. But anyway, Mr. Henry, let's see. I've looked at the chart. So people go to www.cityonthehill.tv, and it's called Obama has failed to create jobs, and you can follow Mr. Henry. But anyway, Mr. Henry, let's see. I'll let you get back. And
okay,
Ms. Ball, I think
great.
We'll be joining us in a few minutes. Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Let's look at these are all great points.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Henry. I see Ms. Barbara. I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to turn you over to Ms. Barbara. Hi, Ms. Barbara.
Okay. Hi, Diana. Hi, Don.
How are you, Barbara?
Thank you. I'm well and so excited about this show, and appreciate so much the focus on job creation. So you just keep right on going, Henry.
Well, let me go ahead, Ms. Barbara, and tell you where we're at, and maybe you will also want to go on our website. And we're on part one, and he is going to go over part two also. So we're right at I don't know if you're able to look at it, but he has got a wonderful chart for us Ms. Barbara, comparison between 2009 when Obama came in to office and up to August of this year. So you can see the changes. One of the main points that really is hitting my brain pretty hard is you have to have 150,000 new jobs. That is required just to break even because our population is growing. So that's where we're at with Mr. Henry. I'm going to turn Mr. Henry to you, and Dawn is with us, and she's so excited about this information that we're gleaning. But I'm sorry, Mr. Henry. I'm going to let you go, and
okay,
I'll just listen in.
Okay, thank you. Let's look a little bit at some of Obama's rhetoric on creating jobs. And again, if you go to, like in this case, the White House website, if you can stand that, you know, Democrats have their standard talking points about the number of jobs he's created. And so, okay, what did Obama say when he delivered his last State of the Union message? And that was on January 24th, 2012. Before, of course, joint sessions of Congress, as they often do, he said, and this is a quote from Obama, in the last 22 months, businesses have created more than 3 million jobs. Last year, they created the most jobs since 2005. And then he continued on with the manufacturers and stuff like that. Okay, that's one statement. And then a little more recently, in fact, on August 3rd, this was the same day that the BLS released these employment numbers, by the way. He said the following: this morning, we learned that our businesses created 172,000 new jobs in the month of July. That means that we've now created 4.5 million new jobs over the last 29 months and 1.1 million jobs so far this year. Okay, these are nice statements. And, you know, I would say, on the surface, when you first hear these statements, you'd think, hey, man, I think Obama's doing all right, isn't he? I mean, after all, his policies must really be working if he's creating all these new jobs. And, of course, that's the desired result. When you hear these talking points, you want to be impressed, don't you? I mean, wow, look at the jobs he's creating. He must be doing all right. So
now,
let's do the old...
Henry, qualify who's the we. We have created X jobs.
Right, right. Well,
the government never qualifies that royal we.
Well, you're exactly right. And you know, Don, one of the first statements I made at the very top of this report was these were the statements I made. The government does not create jobs,
mm-hmm.
except jobs for government employees. Rather, the jobs are created by the private sector. But, here's a big but, or however, the government policies can have a huge influence on job creation. So you are exactly right. I mean, really, what kind of jobs does the government create per se, except, you know, more jobs for government workers? But they can play a big part in this whole deal. So, you know, the president, Obama, does like to claim credit for jobs created. And as I said earlier, we even caught his press secretary saying, last year actually, that, in reality, the government doesn't create jobs. Well, yeah, that's true. So anyway, we've got these two statements. And by the way, he has repeated this dozens of times. Where, you know, these are the number of jobs I've created. And he says this over and over and over again. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Please go on and really give us those facts and break it down for us. So.
Okay. Let's do that. Let's do a little fact check. And by the way, you know, I don't think it's any coincidence that he picked a certain date for what I call the base. Or when he started his numbers. So when he says, for example, in January, during the State of the Union, in the last 22 months, and depending whether you start with January or go to December, you know, there's a little bit of variation there. But basically, you go back to March of 2010. And by the way, the statement he made in August, it also harkens back to what I call a base month of March 2010. Okay, let's ask the question. You know, I guess it's the cynical part of me here, but also I'd like to kind of investigate the numbers. Why do you think that Obama's staffers, his staff people, why do you think they selected March 2010 instead of the month that he took office? Any guesses on that? Do you think it might have something possibly to do with he's going to try to make the numbers look as good as possible?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's think about this for a second. Okay, the month that he took office, unemployment rate was 7.7%. And the very next month, it jumped up into the eights, and it's been in above eights, up as high as 10.1% the whole time. So they purposely did not use January 2009 as their base month, but I'm going to. I'm going to do that. And those are the numbers that we looked at 15 minutes ago. But just to stay with this little fact-checking deal for a minute, and maybe this is just we're talking about minor differences here, but when I do this fact-checking thing, I want to see if what he is saying is in his two speeches. Actually, he said it dozens of times, but I'm only citing two different speeches. I'm trying to see if these numbers are correct. And again, I go to the employment numbers, the employment line, straight out of the BLS reports. I look at the report for March 2010. I look at the report for July 2012. And I simply subtract the two numbers. And I find that employment during that period of time grew by 3.3 million people. So when I crank that through, I find that, for his, let's just stay with the August statement for a minute, if we can, to keep from getting too confused. So that's a 29-month period. Based on his statement, he said that he created 155,000 jobs per month, but based on my calculations, it's 113,000. And again, simply subtracting the two numbers in two different months and then dividing by 29 months. So, you know, his speeches are not correct. He's overstating the results. And again, simply by looking at the number of people employed. And you can get away from all this nonsense about jobs created each month and whether it's a positive or negative, and it goes up and down and all over the map. But I'd like to keep it fairly straightforward and simple, and I simply look, okay, how many people were employed, in this case the base month of March 2010, how many people are employed today, subtract the two, and you get a number. So, you know, it's kind of a simple approach, but I think it's one that anyone can verify, and you can see that, you know, we really haven't done very well. The
can
unemployment
I ask you a
rate,
question, Henry, about the statistics that you've done? Did you go ahead and break those down based on ethnicity?
I could. And I have reports that show that, and I should probably do that, Barbara. I think it's Barbara that asked a question, isn't it?
It was Dawn.
Dawn. I'm sorry. It was Dawn.
We're interchangeable at any moment.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm sorry to confuse you, but I really should do that. And I look at those numbers every month, and it's really troubling. I mean, if you think it's bad.
Yeah. The reason I ask is that. I just put on our website, and I'll send it over to Barbara and Diana, it's a little history lesson from Alfonso Rochelle about why the black community is loyal to Democrats and the Democrat mm-hmm. Party. And the interesting thing is that, and I'm not sure most Americans are truly aware of how high the unemployment rate is for black males between the ages of 18 and 24. And it's enormous. I mean, it's double, triple digit what the national unemployment is. So for a group of people, quote unquote, a voting bloc of people, to keep, you know, voting for the same policy that is keeping them unemployed, I find that, you know, horribly sad.
It is sad. And you know, I look at those different groups, and you look at, let's say, Hispanics or blacks, you know, African-Americans, or look at teenagers, look at, you know, these different...
New college graduates.
That's right. I mean, some of these categories, it's horrible. You know, you get kind of a distorted picture when you look at overall, you know, the entire group. But boy, it's when you look at the different parts making up the whole, wow, you're exactly right.
Even
why?
More troubling when you look at it from that perspective, I think. I mean,
that's right.
If there's one great equalizer that has been the world's best equalizer and truly the person that has brought us all together and has totally made us all equal, it is President Obama, because it doesn't matter where you sit, unemployment hits you, and it doesn't matter your age, it doesn't matter, you know, what socioeconomic, unless you are an entrepreneur who is self-sufficient, and God forbid you have prosperity and you've grown, which means you're hiding somewhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, the odds are, Most people that are still employed are just happy to have a job. It's everybody else that's going, you know, I want to work, I need to work, but there's nothing there for me.
That's right. And, you know, his statements, his rhetoric is just, it's appalling. You know, when he says, you know, this was pre-election, we don't have the red states or the blue states, we have the United States. Well, you know,
and
I mean,
yet
yeah.
I've done everything I can to make you people all feel more divided than we've been since the Civil War.
Right. It's the most divided country. He's the most divisive president that we've ever had. This class warfare, it's out of hand. You know, everything he does is class warfare. And really, his whole election strategy, and very few people have verbalized this, the whole thing is based on getting all these different segments of the population. You can just pick one. It can be Hispanics. It can be, and he's doing immigration stuff for them, you know, promising the world, the Dream Act and everything else. To get African Americans, he'll promise them some things. To get the gays, he'll cave in to their movement. You know, just go right on down the line. He thinks if he can get enough of these different separate groups voting for him, that he can get reelected. And that's all part of his strategy.
Right.
And it's horrible. It's a horrible way to run a country. Go ahead.
Would you say then that specific groups, all these different groups, have been targeted by Obama to bring them into his camp?
Definitely. There's no question about it. You know.
Well, yeah. The best way to help him is to have people. I just did a blog recently to try to remind people, because to me, one of the newest questions beyond even, you know, job creation, which should be number one, everybody should be talking about it. But the next question is: Do you feel like you're in a better position economically than you were 4 years ago? There aren't very many people, I think, that could actually. I'm sure it's the less than 1% that could say that they feel like they are, because even the wealthy have lost money. But my thing was, you know, do you feel safer? And we have spent 4+ years now having a person in our White House that has done everything they can to divide us up as a nation. And I ask this people a simple question. How did you feel on September 12th, 2001? Because for the first time in a really, really long time, with actual thought into it, people had come together as one nation, as Americans. And as one nation, we were fighting. And as one nation, we stood together. And as one nation, we sang the national anthem as one people. And now look what we've been devolved to, and everybody's a voting block. Women, blacks, Hispanics, small business, Christians, Jews, Muslims. Every way you can divide us into subsets of people, they've managed to divide us.
Yes, we definitely feel less unity during these 4 years. Well, Henry, Obama's rhetoric creating jobs does not line up with the actual facts. And thank
no, it
you
really,
for
really
showing that to us. And would you like to talk about the failure also of the stimulus?
Let's do that. Let's look at the stimulus bill. Is it a success or failure? And I think, you know, let's just look at some facts. Within, you know, days, actually, after he got into office, he rammed through this stimulus bill through Congress. And clearly, you know, it was written by other folks, and they had it written, obviously, before he was sworn in. So by February 17th, he was sworn in on January 20th, within really a few weeks of taking office, they passed the stimulus bill. I mean, this was $787 billion. And by the time you add the interest and everything else, it's over $1 trillion. And by the way, the bill went up into the $800 billion range, 862, and then dropped back, I guess adjusted to about 814. But again, as we say, when we include interest, it was up over $1 trillion. Okay.
Well, and the funny thing about the stimulus bill, and I'm not sure people know this, is that when it first came out, Heritage was doing a project. It was actually right before the Tea Party started, and it was a project I jumped on because I never looked at numbers before in such a way for government. And Heritage had this project and asked volunteers to help with, which was pulling the money out of the stimulus bill and showing if it was taxing or spending. And showing where, at the time, it was $367 billion. And we knew they were shooting for over $800 billion. So the big question at that stage for me was, where is the rest of the money? Well, the rest of the money hasn't been put in the bill yet because we haven't porked it to death yet. And that's what ended up happening, is that everybody and his brother got something for their own little piece of their cronyism, and that thing ballooned. But it was just when you saw where the money was going, literally pulling it out, looking at it like your own checkbook to justify where X billion is going or X million is going, it was unbelievably, and remember everybody, this was an emergency. This was an emergency that we had to vote on. And most of the, if not all that money went to garbage.
It really did. It really did. You know, even Biden was captured saying this, you know, these open mic comments are really kind of funny, but he even, and some of the other top people with Obama said, you know, never waste an emergency, never waste a moment, you know, and so they took advantage of a crisis situation and rammed this bill through. You remember, of course, that he promised that unemployment would never exceed 8% if this thing was passed. Well, you know, it's been above the 8% the entire time. In fact, it went up to, it peaked at about 10.1% in October 2009, and it's been high the whole time. Really, stimulus bill, I think people need to step back a little bit and look at what is this stimulus bill based on. It's based on John Maynard Keynes, the Keynesian model of economics. And the theory goes that if you rapidly increase spending, that it will propel the economy forward. Well, this theory, it really breaks down very quickly and fails because, you know, if you could do this with the money that you have in the Treasury, it would be a different story. But when you have to have a stimulus bill that's based on borrowing money, then all you're doing is adding to the national debt. And when you're out there in the marketplace, federal government, when you are competing with the private sector and everyone else for the limited amount of capital, then, you know, the money that you take there, it's drawn out of the economy. So really what I like to say, and someone else coined this little word picture, but I think it captures it pretty well. The Keynesian theory is like trying to raise the level of water in a swimming pool by taking water out of the other end and then dumping it in the opposite end. It doesn't work very well, does it? And that's really all you're doing with Keynesian economics. taking water out of the pool and dumping it in the other end. And I don't think the level of the water, I'm not too great at physics, but I don't think it's going to rise too well, is it, when you do that?
No, so now that's kind of called the blended theory, to blend socialism with free enterprise. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a little different setup, but you know, we know that the stimulus was just a big, huge failure, and various people they've tried to say that it was great and it created all these jobs, but I think the numbers that we've looked at indicates the exact opposite. It has not created jobs. Another aspect, and you know, as a construction man, I guess I can't refrain from dipping into the construction aspect of it a little bit. But you remember all of the promises, and part of the sales pitch for this whole stimulus bill was that we're going to create all these shovel-ready construction jobs. And you remember Obama kind of joking with some of these, the economic advisors and the jobs council, and he stood up there and said, well, I guess they weren't so shovel-ready after all. Yeah, well, they weren't, you know. But and he kind of laughed about it, but it's not a laughing matter. Again, Barbara, and actually Dawn, I guess, when you were looking at this, at the work with the Heritage, they actually dug into this thing a little bit. How much of the stimulus was actually devoted to infrastructure spending? And they determined that it was only $105 billion. Well, that's 13% of the total bill. So for all the hoopla and fanfare about fixing our nation's decaying bridges and infrastructure, and it is decaying, there's no question about it. I know it very well, that we have lots of things in this country falling apart. And when a bridge falls apart because it's of deterioration, rust, whatever, it kind of drops. And we've had, it's not a laughing matter. You know, when a bridge drops and lives are lost, it's a pretty serious deal. But anyway,
do we know how much of that actually went or has been spent on actual infrastructure, though?
Well, the figures were, it was supposed to be about $105 billion. And if we assume that most of the stimulus was spent, then I would say it's probably in that neck of the woods, roughly 13%, which is not a very high percentage, is it?
Well, and not only that, I would actually doubt that that's what the money went to, because if you're like my state of California, you dumped it into the general fund and you've been stealing from Peter to pay Paul. So,
sure.
You know, and I still have potholes that have had the same potholes on my street for, and it's a major, you know, residential thoroughfare for 15 years. So,
yeah.
You know, it's the whole idea. Especially if you're coming from the perspective, this is what I love about this show, we stated at the beginning, David Barton says, know your history. But if you look back at the works projects that FDR tried to get done, you know, nobody ever equates that to a time in our history as a nation where people weren't overly educated. Most people weren't educated beyond high school, if that, let alone, I mean, it was a big deal if you went to college. And so to have shovel-ready jobs, because that's what people did. There were a lot of people that did manual labor versus, you know, computer or office-type work or white-collar employment. Now, because of the way our society has moved, most of those people, I would love to see white-collar versus manual labor for the unemployment. I don't even know if the Bureau of Statistics of Labor keeps statistics like that, because I think that would be an interesting look at what it is. Because you can't use the same plan that worked 60, 70 years ago for a completely different society for now. I mean, I thought it was stupid then. Well, we're asking the guy who's the teacher, the professor from Cambridge that's now out of his job to pick up a shovel and what, build a highway? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
all that money
gives right.
Would go to unions, by the way. So
that's right. Yeah, Dawn, to answer your question, they do look at all those different demographic groups. And I've seen it on the BLS reports. They do list white collar. They list, of course, the different ethnic groups and that sort of thing. So they do break it out quite a bit, and the numbers are quite interesting when you look at it. But this construction business, okay, you know, what I every month I looked at the unemployment numbers, starting really from when Obama took office, and every month I would see the unemployment rate for construction. It would be double or triple what it was for the economy as a whole. And let's say, for example, in one particular month, February 2010, when the general unemployment rate was 9.7%, it was a whopping 27% for construction. I mean, think about it. One out of three construction workers was out of work, was unemployed.
Exactly. And one of the other parts of this whole thing, I think, with the government that isn't talked about a lot is that the overregulation has completely decimated some industries in my state, which is overregulated by the environmental Nazis to the point of job extinction. They aren't creating cement here because that's a polluting business. So you have to import cement. We've just increased a lumber tax, a 1% tax on lumber. Anything that contains 10% or more of actual wood is going to be taxed now. So this, what does this do to the housing industry, furniture makers, you name it? So all those things ripple through the economy, and it decimates a business, which says, guess what? Not only can I not add more jobs, but we're going to have to get rid of some of you.
That's true. If it's okay at this juncture, why don't we move into the next aspect? I think maybe hopefully we haven't beaten it totally to death. People are bored to tears, but on the creation of jobs, I'd like to look at the next part, the next aspect of this picture, and that would be, why do I say Obama is the job killer? Is that an overstated thing, or what basis would I have for saying that he's a job killer? That he's not only not helped the problem, he's exacerbated it. He's made it worse. And so I would submit that he does deserve the title Obama the job killer. Okay, now, why do I say that? And so I'd like to just move through. I've only listed nine, and I had to cut it off somewhere. And by the way, all of you know that one of my biggest problems is I make reports that are too long. And so one of these days, I don't know if I'll ever improve on that score, but I did have to cut it off someplace. And, for example, I left out regulations, and there were just dozens of categories that I could have included. But I chose to include nine of why I say Obama is a job killer. So let's start off with the first one. Okay, Obamacare, his wonderful health care measure, is killing jobs. And, you know, why would I say that? And, you know, you mentioned Heritage Foundation, and of course I rely on them very heavily for lots of the facts and figures. Obamacare is one of the biggest job killers. And there are three aspects, again, coming from Heritage, so it's a good, reliable source. Number one was the employer mandate. Obamacare requires all businesses with 50 or more full-time employees to provide health coverage for their workers. Or if they don't, they have to pay a $2,000 penalty for each employee after the first 30 workers. So what does this do to us? Okay, it does a couple things that are fairly obvious. Number one, let's think about this from the employer's standpoint. Let's just see, okay, if I'm planning on expanding my business, let's say I'm sitting at 37 employees, do you think I'm going to add 3 or 4 or 5 employees if I know full well that in doing so, I'm going to be thrown into the throes of Obamacare?
No,
you're not going to do it. Instead of hiring, you're going to hold fast where you are. Even though you would love to expand, let's say you've got a friend of mine runs a Subway shop, okay? let's say he had the opportunity to open a second store. And this may not be the best example because I doubt if they'll get over the 50 workers. But, you know, maybe I should pick a better example. But you know what I'm saying. Instead of expanding, you're going to hold fast where you are, and that is depriving people of a potential job right there because of the 50-employee threshold. The other thing that happens is, and that is, how much does this cost you? That mandate to supply Obamacare, that increases the cost of hiring. Again, this is a heritage figure. If it's a full-time single worker, it costs an extra $10 an hour because of Obamacare, just that one measure. And by the way, if you have a family, that family health care coverage would cost you an additional $13.75 an hour. And again, that depends on the state. If you're in California where you live, Don, you know, it's a fairly expensive cost of living. So I would submit that $10 an hour and $13.75 is not going to begin to cut it. Maybe overall countrywide it might work, but, you know, so what you're going to do instead of
And remember, hiring, that's only if you're employed full-time, right?
That's right, exactly. And you're bringing up an excellent point. And that's the next one is instead of hiring full-time employees, it's the oldest trick in the book. You will hire dozens of part-time folks. So you don't have to, you know, provide health benefits and the whole bit. So, yeah, that's the oldest trick in the book, and lots of businesses do that. Okay, the second aspect.
That's also one of the reasons people join unions, I'm finding. I'm hearing more and more, is because they feel like nobody really has their back. Here they're very amiable to different changes to their schedule, and they're just out of reach by an hour, half hour, whatever, of being considered full-time. So they don't get the same as somebody else. And they're basically their schedule's monkeyed about with so that the employer doesn't have to meet those requirements. But in the meantime, you've got the person out there having to juggle this without really any benefit to them other than, oh, thank God I have a job. But, you know, the employer's going to go out of his way to make sure he doesn't hit that threshold where I'm concerned because he doesn't want to have to pay this.
Certainly, that's exactly right. Another aspect of Obamacare that is killing jobs is the new taxes and regulations. So Obamacare imposes 18 new taxes, and that totals $502 billion in the first 10 years. And Heritage found that they really start ramping up and becoming even bigger in later decades, you know, when some of the other provisions of Obamacare kick in, the tax provisions, it gets up to $1.7 trillion per decade, per 10 years, after the first decade. So those new taxes and regulations are really going to be a job killer. And, of course, that has the effect of slowing economic growth. It destroys jobs. It's really bad news for the economy. And
here's my question for you about that, just before we get off that, is so because of this, like we said, so you're going to have people who are underemployed. They're not going to part-time, less than full-time, whatever, because obviously the employer doesn't want to, you know, get jammed up for this. So where does this put those people? Because the big thing about the push for this health care was that everybody would have health care. So what does this do now? This pushes the person out into a quote-unquote state exchange or some federal exchange for health care, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But
here's the thing. So you're underemployed because your employer doesn't want to have to pay the extra money. But guess what? You're going to get taxed by that to pay anyway because how government doesn't create revenue, it is us they get it from, and somebody's got to pay for your state and federal exchanges.
That's right. So it's a self-defeating deal, and as more and more voters wake up to these facts, I think it'll make a difference in this election. But, you know, people have got to think about this on a bigger picture. They've got to, you know, let's face it, everyone tends to be quite selfish when they are voting, but you've got to look at what's going to benefit our country and all of these folks who are unemployed. That's really important. And the third aspect, we could talk about lots of them, within Obamacare still, and that is the unpredictable future costs and the regulations that it involves. There are 33% of the business owners cited new requirements in Obamacare as either the biggest or the second biggest obstacle to hiring. And here's a quote from a reliable source, Dennis Lockhart, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. He said the following. This is a direct quote. "We have frequently heard strong comments to the effect of, my company won't hire a single additional worker until we know what health insurance costs are going to be." I mean, so, you know, this is what's going on out there. You know, you have lots of businesses, they're saying, I don't know what's going to happen, and so until I do, I'm not going to hire. So really, business hiring has been frozen across this country as they're waiting to see what's going to happen with this Obamacare deal. Okay, the next aspect, and again, we've had reports on this I've put out in the last few months about Taxmageddon. Okay, Taxmageddon, that's point number two in terms of Obama killing jobs. The Taxmageddon thing, and of course, these are the whole series of tax increases that are going to hit January 1st, 2013, only a few months from now. We're going to see $494 billion, with a B, in tax hikes on January 1st if the Congress and the White House cannot get their act together negate these or disallow these. So we're going to see the largest tax increase in history hitting January 1st if they fail to act. And that's big. And so businesses, because of that, they are holding off on hiring. And the thing is, people have to realize, okay, it's going to hit January 1st, but the impact is already hitting us as we speak. In fact, starting many months ago, there are lots of folks that have already started laying off workers. They've already started firing workers because of they're anticipating this this Taxmageddon thing that happens January 1st. So it's already had an impact. It's not it's going to, you know, really get bad January 1st. Yes, it'll get worse at that point, but it's already hurting us. Uncertainty. Let's look at this for a moment. Whether you are a person, an individual, a family, a business, an investor, a banker, no matter who you are, we hate uncertainty. I mean, uncertainty is just you don't know what to count on. And, you know, I've heard this so many times. All these politicians, they decry the fact that billions of dollars are sitting on the sidelines, as if, you know, all these folks are just, they're evil or something, because they're sitting on the sidelines with this money when they should be investing and spending it. Well, you know, first of all, you can't force people to invest or save or spend. You know, they're only going to do it if they feel confident in the future. And these businesses, they're not going to invest if they don't know what's going to happen. See, this uncertain business climate, it's a job killer. It destroys things. I like to say that this economy is stuck in neutral, and we need to put it in gear so we can take off and go down the road. But this, you know, Obama's plan, for example, to repeal the Bush tax cuts, but it's a selective deal. It's only for incomes over $200,000 or $250,000 for joint, and that's going to kill jobs because these are precisely the people who create the most jobs. You know, how many people that are making, just to pick a number, $30,000 are going to create lots of jobs? They're not. You know, it's the people at the upper end of the scale whether you like that fact or not. That's just kind of the way it works. So,
clinician success.
What was that? I'm sorry.
I said it's punishing success.
It really is. It really is. There's kind of two interconnected issues that are in play here, Taxmageddon and the fiscal cliff. And I like to use the term Taxmageddon because that refers strictly to the tax increases that are going to hit January 1st. But when you combine those tax increases with the mandatory federal spending cuts, the reductions, then the two become what they call the fiscal cliff. And but a lot of people don't quite make that distinction between those two terms. But the fiscal cliff is really what most people these days, all the talking heads on the different programs, a lot of those folks use that term. But, you know, I looked at a very recent CBO report. This was August 22nd, so pretty short time ago. They issued a report, and they said that if we do not do something about this fiscal cliff, Taxmageddon thing, they are predicting a recession next year, 2013. So this isn't some economist sitting over there in a corner of some Ivy League or some university somewhere or in some corporation. This is the CBO saying that if we don't fix this Taxmageddon thing, we will have a recession next year. And that should get people's attention. And by the way, the Republican-led House, they passed a bill that would extend the Bush tax cuts. But guess what? Old Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, he won't even allow a vote on that measure. And Obama has said if it comes to his desk, he will veto it. So there you go. You know, Republicans have done their part. But and I get so sick of these partisan statements that says, well, Congress can't get anything done. Well, yeah, they can't. But, you know, it takes both sides. And, you know, you've got the Republican side of the House. They are passing bills. They've passed a jobs measure. They've passed this measure. But it gets nowhere because our buddy over in the Senate, old Reid, does this pocket veto business, and there it sits. It gets nowhere. It just, you know, just shoved in his pocket somewhere. Okay, another aspect that is a job killer, and again, we're going back to why we say Obama is a job killer. Okay, the third one would be extending the unemployment insurance. Okay, let's say you increase it by 20 weeks. You add some additional weeks to it. You think, you know, the Democrats think they're being compassionate when they do that, but let's just step back a moment and think about this a bit. And see, a lot of people don't understand really how unemployment compensation works. And the deal is, it's like an insurance plan. And, you know, I haven't met an insurance company yet or a salesman or talked to anyone in an insurance company. They don't exactly like to lose money, do they? And they have a penchant for wanting to make money. It's kind of a funny capitalistic concept. But anyway, what happens, because this is basically an insurance program, if, and it works like insurance, this unemployment compensation, what happens if an employee collects $10,000 in unemployment? The employer is probably going to end up paying an additional $20,000 or so for increased premiums. So it's kind of a losing proposition, you know, and the employer, you know, the employee, let's say, the guy that was laid off, he thinks, oh man, this is great. I'm getting this unemployment money. Well, because it's basically set up like an insurance plan, there are no free rides in this world. And so the employer indirectly ends up paying because of that. So that is going to limit the hiring of new people. And there again, looking at it from the employer's side, I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to hire any new folks if I know that all it's going to do if that person becomes unemployed, it's going to add to my unemployment insurance premiums. So what it means is you are less likely to hire a new employee. And again, that holds down job creation. So it's a job killer. Okay, a fourth aspect of how Obama kills jobs in this country is the free trade agreements. And really, I've heard very little about this in the last few months. But let's go back to he had a his first State of the Union address. Obama set a very ambitious goal. He said, a quote, "I want to double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America." So that's what his goal was. Very lofty. You know, he's a great speech deliverer. All right, I'm not going to say great, but some people think he's good at delivering a speech. By the way, he's not a good. He can only deliver the speech. He's not a great speaker. But anyway, he made this statement. Okay, what has he done? We've gone nowhere. We've got these what they call free trade agreements. We've got one pending that will be an agreement with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. And most estimates range well above 100,000 new jobs that would be created as a direct result of these free trade agreements. And yet, he won't sign them. And he's holding it hostage to another program, this Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. And until he gets what he wants there, apparently he's not going to talk turkey and sign the bill. So there it sits. Again, all he's killing jobs because the agreement that should have been signed years ago sits in some drawer somewhere, going nowhere. And, you know, again, being in construction, I love to follow the activities. You know, I read an engineering magazine, Engineering News Record, every week, and it's talked a lot about this Panama Canal project. That's a $5 billion expansion of the Panama Canal. You know, we originally built that canal in 1914. Of course, Panama is a separate country today, not part of the U.S., but this, it's a huge construction project. They're going to add a third set of locks, and they're going to make the whole facility able to accommodate much larger ships. So it's a big deal. It's a big project. And yet, you know, because this free trade agreement has not been signed, it means that U.S. companies can get very little out of this project. So another place where he's killed jobs. Okay, let's move to the next one, his moratorium on oil drilling. And, of course, none of us like to see that oil flowing out of the BP at Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we saw those ugly pictures, you know, remember, of the oil spewing from out of the wellhead. And it was a bad deal. I mean, it's no question about it. But what he did is he slapped a moratorium on deepwater oil drilling, and it was a six-month moratorium. But here's the interesting thing, and again, it's the shady dealings aspect. There was a team of seven experts, and these were experts in the field, and they wrote a report. And then here's what happened. Here's the sneaky part about it. They wrote a report, and then they came along after the fact, Secretary of the Interior and some of the other Obama folks. They wrote a different conclusion after these seven experts had done their thing. And so a House committee issued subpoenas in April of this year, and this was reported out in the Washington Times, but they were caught in the act. They edited the report after these folks had looked at it, and they it was a false report. They made a false claim. So, you know, it's another example where if you don't exactly get the results you're looking for, then you doctor it and you change the report, and that's what happened here. Okay, another one kind of also in the environmental area is the Keystone XL pipeline. And, you know, I live in Nebraska. This Keystone pipeline will pass through this state and on its way to Oklahoma and eventually to Texas. Okay, this thing has been studied to death. You know, they've had 3 years of environmental review. They've had a very successful environmental impact statement. And in that statement, by the way, they said there might be a very small potential for water contamination, but it would be minimal and in a very limited area. But in spite of all that, Obama on November 10th, 2011, almost a year ago, he announced that he's going to, get this, delay a decision on the pipeline until after the election. Now, if that doesn't sound like it's politics, I don't know what is, you know.
That's right.
So what he did, basically, is he caved into his environmental folks, and this is, you know, he's got a bunch of unions in his fold. I mean, unions typically vote for Democrats, last time I checked. And so, you know, so let's see. You're sitting back. You're Obama. You're looking out the window in the Oval Office, and you're thinking, let's see. Should I side with my environmental lobby, environmental folks, extreme environmentalists, or should I side with the unions and with the folks wanting to create jobs? Well, he chose to go with the environmental people. And so what happened there is, and there are different estimates, but they say, you know, it was a bare minimum of 20,000 jobs. And I've looked at the reports, and the 20,000 is just the beginning. When you count all of the side jobs, peripheral jobs, the, you know, the jobs of in these different states of, you know, your local corner grocery store and hardware
sure.
store and whatever, then it's a number that's, you know, probably about 6 or 7 times that. So
yeah,
the 20,000
jobs.
That's
yeah.
right. So the 20,000.
And Henry, doesn't this contrast greatly with the Romney-Ryan policies and plans? They are definitely for this Keystone pipeline, are they not?
Oh, definitely. They really are, yes, and they certainly are. And very much in favor of that. That would be, they would release that the day Romney-Ryan take office. They will give the Keystone pipeline a go-ahead. They've already pledged that, and I know for a fact it'll take place. And by the way, without getting too far off the subject, you know, I spent the first 2 years after I graduated from college with the undergraduate degree, I spent it in the service, and I actually worked for the National Air Pollution Control Administration. So and that was for a couple years. I do have a background in environmental aspects, and so, you know, these things are not foreign to me. I can look at a report and I can make some sense out of it. And really, they did everything they could in the environmental studies and in their planning for this pipeline to make sure that there would be no problems associated with it. And you know, and if there is a leak, there's a leak detection system that picks it up right away. The pipeline would be, of course, brand new, and it would be the best pipeline we have in the country in terms of all of the safety aspects of it. So, but the environmental people, they have made this their primary cause. They have characterized the oil coming from Canada, again, our very friendly neighbors to the north. They've characterized it as, this is really dirty oil. This is the worst stuff that you could possibly have going through a country. And so, you know, they hate this Keystone pipeline even more than they hate dams or nuclear power plants or almost anything else. They made this their main cause. So anyway, taking out strikes against it. Again, staying with this environmental theme, the next one would be Obama's EPA regulations on coal, and he's really made coal a dirty word. he wants to really go to war against against coal. And so, and again, a direct quote from Obama, he promised that electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket as a result of his cap-and-trade system. And he also said, this is a quote from Obama, "So if someone wants to build a coal power plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they are going to be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas that's being emitted." And by the way, all of you, you've had people on your program. And the greenhouse gas, it's total and utter baloney. I can tell you, I've written reports when I was with the National Air Pollution Control Administration. I wrote reports on the and assisted in developing reports on the health effects of the different pollutants. And I can tell you for a fact that carbon dioxide, that's the very air that we breathe out and that plants need, carbon dioxide is not an air pollutant. And it never will be. It's a harmless gas. And yet it's the carbon dioxide that these guys are going after. They're calling it a greenhouse gas. And it's pure baloney. And again, we developed what they called air quality criteria documents. And yes, something like ozone, something like particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, sulfur trioxide, these are harmful air pollutants, no question about it. But I can tell you for a fact that there are no adverse health effects associated with carbon dioxide. So that's
a delicate balance.
It's false. It's pure baloney. So anyway, I've seen different numbers, but there are probably 14,000 jobs at stake with just the lignite mining. And then when you include the other types of mining, it's even more than that. And again, just on a personal note, I hope you don't mind all these little dumb little stories, but I actually worked on as project engineer on building a coal mine in West Virginia. So I think I can kind of appreciate what a coal mine's all about. And we sunk two shafts and a slope and did a bunch of work. People don't realize that these coal mines have to get built somehow, and coal mining companies don't build them. They hire a contractor to do that, then they take over and start mining. But anyway, Obama definitely has initiated a war on coal, and so I'll tell you, when these coal miners wake up to this fact that he's destroying their industry, I don't think they're going to vote Democrat and vote for Obama. Okay, another aspect of job killers, and I'm kind of running through these, but I'd like to catch these different aspects. Okay, how do you think the increased deficit spending, that's a job killer? And again, why do I say that? Well, just like we talked about some time ago here about the national debt. I looked at the national debt figures when he was sworn in, look at it today, and these are numbers as of a month ago, actually, but it was an increase of $5.4 trillion, simply subtracting the two numbers. And so what happens is when the government is competing with the private sector for funds, then the private sector comes up short. We just explained this a little while ago. So this... the high debt levels, they will decrease the gross domestic product. And the CBO has already said this. And this is hampering job growth. Okay, here's the next aspect. And we kind of hinted at this a little while ago on this program. The competition from various assistance programs, welfare programs, that can be a job killer. And why do we say that? Well, I think, here's an old phrase. It's kind of old and tired and worn out. But, for thousands of years, there was an old adage that said, if a man does not work, the man does not eat. And see, we've totally pushed that under the rug. We've forgotten about it. And, you know, we've kind of gone a different way in this country. And, you know, here's an important thing that I think all of us need to convey. And I hope, you know, Romney, Ryan, these other folks will convey this, and they have. But they need to probably say it a little bit more. And that is Republicans, conservative Republicans, let's say, we still believe in a safety net for the truly needy. And I would define that as people, some people, they do need help. They are the elderly, if you're mentally or physically disabled, and those people who simply cannot work. Now, you know, I think most of us would probably agree that a safety net for those folks is the right thing to do. So it's not like that we have no compassion. We do. But
well, and it's not as if we haven't had the vulnerable, sick, infirmed, needy throughout history. The difference is that private enterprise, such as faith-based programs, usually took care of those people. It wasn't the government that did it. And FDR decided, guess what? And you know, fortunately, it's not just you talking about it, Henry. Somebody came out with an article recently that the food stamps were the new bread line.
That's right. That's right. And yeah, we've had several reports that I've put out, you know, on the welfare program and food stamps and that sort of thing. And yes, you know, there's a huge growth in these programs. And see what happens when the government is too generous, then that competes there in the job sector, and it destroys any incentive that there might be to work. And for example, we talked about this a little bit before, but when you increase the unemployment compensation and you bump that up to 99 weeks, for example, that destroys any incentive to go out and look for a job. And I've talked to different people who've been unemployed, and when you are getting that unemployment check, I mean, you can't live on it, but you know, you can get by. And a person will say, you know, shoot, if I'm going to go out and get a job for, let's just pick a number, $7-$8 an hour, they'll tell you it doesn't pay. I will be better off staying unemployed and drawing the unemployment compensation than I would be getting a low-paying job. So, you know, it's counterproductive. You know, we talked about this job creation a little while ago in the first part of this program, and one of the figures that came out of the BLS reports was that 7.7 million people had dropped out of the labor force. But so these folks, they're getting their needs met through these different welfare programs. There again, they have no incentive to work because they are getting their needs met. Let's look at general welfare spending. Again, lots of facts and figures, but I think this helps to prove the case. Under Obama, welfare spending has increased 3 times faster than the prior increases. It was $522 billion on welfare spending in 2008. It jumped to $717 billion by 2011. That was a 37% increase in 3 years, almost 40%. Another aspect of welfare. This is the one that gets all the attention, but it rightfully should, because it's the biggest. Food stamps. Under Obama, food stamp spending has more than doubled. It's gone from $39 billion in 2008 to $81 billion in 2012, more than doubled. The number of people on food stamps has grown from 31 million in 2008 to 45 million by 2011. And today it's about almost 47 million people on food stamps. And I divided these through myself, and I got 1 in 6. So 1 in 6 people in this country are on food stamps. And that's a scary
number.
That's
just disgraceful. That is just shameful.
And so I would submit that, I think he rightfully deserves the title the food stamp president, because he's actively promoting the program. And, you know, we've seen all kinds of abuses. We've seen some of these ads that run on TV. And,
yeah,
of course, most of these actual commercials to get people
I haven't
convinced.
Even seen those commercials. What do they say?
Well, they're little vignettes. They will tell people, well, gee, you're a fool if you don't sign up for food stamps, and you need to, you know, get part of this action here. And there's even been initiatives where the Obama administration has teamed up with the Mexican government to reach immigrants to convince them that, hey, come to the United States. We got a really good food stamp program here. Isn't that an abuse of your executive privilege? It's just
horrible. Well, we put that right next to the tourism, you know, come to America.
That's right. That's right. Housing assistance. All of those housing assistance programs under the welfare programs, there's no time limits. There's no work requirements built in there. And so what happens is they get more and more people signed up. Here's another one that doesn't get a lot of attention.
No citizenship requirements, although they're supposed to be. They obviously don't exist.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Social Security disability.
Mr. Henry?
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Henry. I've been listening to y'all, and I just want to join in just for a little bit.
Okay.
If you can hear me about the citizenship requirement, I think this is the greatest disservice of all, Don. Many states just look the other way. They know these people are coming in. They are illegal. But state government is pretty much, you know, giving that line of we're just going to look the other way. A lot of state governments. I guess I can't say that of every state government. But that has been the policy there for a long, long time. And so really, you know, we know how to solve the problem. The thing is, our government has not been forced to. They've looked the other way. So I just want to put that in, and having worked in food stamps, it is demoralizing to continue to be on food stamps, but it becomes a way of life. And so this is what we're raising generations that, you know, this is all they're used to. That's the way their parents live, and they don't see themselves getting out, especially with Obama's changes, with doing without the work requirement. So. But anyway, I just enjoyed it, Mr. Henry. I just wanted to tune in and tell y'all that.
That's certainly correct.
And housing assistance.
Housing assistance is a bad one. The food stamps, you get this huge group of people on food stamps. They've been on it for 8 years, 10 years. They've been on it for a long time. You know, originally it was supposed to be a very short-term deal. And again, I think most of us would have compassion on a temporary basis. But I'll tell you what, when someone's on it for 10 years, 12 years, 20 years, there's something wrong. You know, it's not a temporary handout. It's not a helping hand. It's hurting them. Here's another aspect that doesn't get a lot of attention, but the Social Security disability. And that's, of course, a program where if you're disabled, then you'll get some money from the government. Well, what's happened is there are so many people signing up for the Social Security Disability Program that they are actually paying out more money today than they're taking in through payroll taxes. So that's a disaster waiting to happen right there. And what's happening here with that disability program is that a lot of people are faking their disabilities in order to qualify for that program. And so that's running up the big tab. And Don, I might just mention, I have a brother, a twin brother, who lives out in California. And without, you know, getting into lots of the private details, he's actually testified in various trials as an expert witness against what they call malingerers. And these are folks that are faking it. They're faking an injury. And,
oh, yeah.
And so they're on the dole, and he's testified against that.
I've seen these videos of these people, the guy that claims the horrific back injury, and there's a video of the guy jet skiing, you know, on his great vacation
mm-hmm.
in Florida.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah, those are really, they really are. Another one here is the elimination of the welfare work requirements. And actually, Heritage broke that story in July about the Obama administration. They had gutted, he had single-handedly, you know, along with Health and Human Services, they gutted the work requirement that Clinton and the boys, you know, put through in the 1996 welfare reform law. So even though they had said work requirements are extremely important, and I heard a testimony recently, and it was they were talking about how when they wrote that the welfare reform bill, they wrote it with ironclad teeth in it. You know, that there were no loopholes. I mean, they wrote it to be very stringent about the work requirements. But here you've got Obama and HHS Secretary, they're the two of them working together. They just said, okay, we can waive those requirements. We can I like to say Obama's not a king and America is not a monarchy. And yet that's what he's doing. He bypasses Congress whenever he feels like it, and he changes the rules by executive fiat. And by the way, here's an interesting thing, and I don't think many people realize this. This is something that Heritage has revealed and dug out, and that is there was a hidden provision in the stimulus bill that had already waived the work requirement in the food stamp program. So, you know, it's almost like that Obamacare, that famous Nancy Pelosi line, you know, pass it so we'll know what's in it. Well, the stimulus bill was pretty much the same thing. There, not a single legislator was able to read that stimulus bill before it was rammed through and passed. And so here's this little-known provision that they were able to sneak into the stimulus bill where it took away the work requirement. So, you know, it's just lots and lots of examples of this thing. So after hearing all these, let me just ask you folks, do you think, objectively, do you think that Obama does deserve the title Obama the Job Killer?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, Henry, I'd like to point out that work requirement and the welfare reform was done by a Republican Congress, both House and Senate. And they really forced Bill Clinton into approving that. You know, that was under his administration, but that was a conservative Congress, a Republican Senate and House that did that. And that is just so outrageous.
You're exactly right.
The stimulus bill and the hidden things in the Obamacare as well. This is absolutely outrageous. And yes, Obama does deserve the job killer title.
Yeah. You know, I've been talking way too much. Are there some questions that maybe you have in the next few minutes that maybe we can explore? Not too much time, I suppose. But
I'm sorry?
Questions? Are there any questions you might have, Don, or Barbara, or Diana, that maybe we haven't covered very well here?
I'm looking forward to how you discussing on Wednesday, how do we get out of this now? Because I think that's where we all are. I think even those people that understand, maybe not a huge part of this, but I love the fact that you boil it all down to really understandable numbers and in a way that this is basic math, folks. The man has done all the work for you and has done it objectively because that's the only way to deal with numbers. And, you know, there's no more ignoring it. How much more? I mean, if I hear one more person from Obama's campaign says that, you know, well, it's going to take more than 4 years, what, to destroy the country completely? Because we're at our knees now. So all I want to know is how do we dig out from this aside from making sure he's not reelected?
You're exactly right, and that's what I would like for us to cover on Wednesday is Romney's plan and how it will create millions of jobs.
Mr. Henry, if I may, I think we might be going to be running out of time, so I want to get this in and ask us to pray before we get cut off. It may let us stay on. I'm not sure. Sometimes it cuts us off. Ms. Bob, would you mind closing us in prayer?
Oh, thank you, Diana. And, you know, I'd like to point out also that this information is available on our CityOnAHill.tv website. and the podcast will be available for sharing right there on our website. And Henry, is there anywhere else that this information is located?
Yes, we do have that. We've posted this. If you look at the reports, we posted this on a number of different websites. So people can go to those and click on those links and get these reports.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Well, let's
pray
together. Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank you, Father, that it is your doing, Father, that you have created us so wonderfully to be able to learn, that we have the capacity, Lord, to grow in knowledge. And that's your desire for us, to grow in knowledge and understanding and wisdom for these times, Father, that I pray that we would be like the tribe of Issachar, that they understood the times in which they were living, and they grew in knowledge and understanding and wisdom to prepare for these times. We thank you, Father, that you do not leave us helpless or hopeless in facing all the challenges that are before us. But you desire, Lord, to equip us for those challenges. And so we'll be able to act rightly, Father, to apply this knowledge rightly during these times that you have chosen for us to live in. We thank you. We give you all the praise and the glory, Father, for raising up Henry Burke for this hour, for raising up Don Wildman for this hour, for raising up Diana Cruz for this hour. Lord, that we'll be able to get this information out that is so necessary, Father, for our survival as a people, as a nation. And we praise you and we glorify you, Lord, for doing this. We thank you, our Father in heaven. How wonderful you are. How glorious you are. We just love you so much, Father. And we thank you for all you are doing. Father, your word tells us that your eyes run to and fro over the whole earth to show your might on behalf of those who love you and trust you and serve you, Lord. We thank you and we give you praise, Lord. In Jesus' mighty and precious name, amen.
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 Well, we thank you, guests, Henry Burke and Don Wildman. We thank you for joining us today on City on a Hill Radio Show. And listeners, we would ask that you would share this podcast with your friends, your family, anyone that you can share it with, not only in this country, but throughout the world. We have a world that is in dire need of truth, and you will get that on in this podcast and the many others that are posted at City on a Hill website, cityonahill.tv. So, listeners, we thank you for joining us today, and we ask the Lord to bless you, to make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you, to lift up his countenance upon you and bless you greatly. And we also ask that the Lord would bless this great country and always bless our troops and bless those in Israel. We pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and we always ask the Lord to raise up laborers to share the gospel throughout this country and the world. Listeners, thank you for joining us at City on the Hill Radio Show, and tune in again tomorrow for a wonderful show, and Wednesday when we're going to look, we'll have Henry Burke with us again to look at the solutions. So thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.